This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings. Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
Welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio's podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Sarah Pennell, standing in for Georgie Frost, here with you on DAB across the country, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. And I'm joined in the studio by editor Simon Lambert and Lee Boyce, consumer affairs editor from This Is Money, to talk through some of the stories on their award-winning website they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, we're going to be looking at, what else? Brexit, of course.
Well, we can certainly survive outside the EU. I think the question for us is, how do we thrive? How do we do best? How do we create opportunities and jobs and chances for our children and our grandchildren? That, to me, is what this debate is about.
Also, Bank of England rates remain the same amidst fears of the economic shock of us pulling out of the EU.
A vote to leave the European Union could have material economic effects on the exchange rate, on demand, and on the economy's supply potential.
New ONS figures show continued stagnation of inflation. Will it ever get towards the 2% Bank of England target? Nervous investors are funneling their money out of the EU and picking a somewhat surprising safe haven.
The Japanese number one concern, obviously, is the perpetuity of the Britain being the window for the Japanese European businesses.
The Spanish Supreme Court that rules UK citizens may receive compensation for Spanish developers going bust. This Is Money is presented in partnership with NS&I. Now let's get straight into it. Where can we start? But of course with the rolling BHS scandal. Now the team and Georgie Frost spoke about it last week and the media cycle just keeps going. This week it was Philip Green's turn to go in front of the Business and Pensions Treasury Select Committees. And if you thought Mike Ashley of Sports Direct came off a little grumpy and confrontational, that was nothing.
Sir, do you mind not looking at me like that all the time? It's really disturbing. Sorry? No, you just want to stare at me. It's just uncomfortable, that's all.
I wasn't quite just staring at you, but I don't wish to make you uncomfortable.
Sorry?
I don't wish to make you uncomfortable.
No, but I'm just saying, this is somebody else, but it's just uncomfortable sort of staring at me.
Well, that was Sir Philip Green clashing with MP Richard Fuller at the committee. But he did make some concessions to the 20,000 people whose pensions stand in jeopardy. As the BHS Pension Fund currently sits within the Pension Protection Fund, some of them are expected to receive quite a lot less than they were promised for a lifetime of work. Here's Deborah Hargreaves from the High Pay Centre commenting on Green's performance on Wednesday and on the state of the pensions.
Well, for him, I think it was fairly good temper because he did manage 6 hours without swearing his head off, which is, I think, fairly unusual. But yeah, he was a bit flustered. And it was a kind of interesting sight to see him being televised, sitting there like that without advisers next to him, you know, having to do it on his own. I think the MPs really want to try and get to the bottom of this, but obviously it's very difficult. It's a kind of difficult forum because you're on public display. I mean, I think it's important that business people are called to account in this way. It's about the only forum where they are and they have to talk about it in a reasonable way. But, I mean, Philip Green brushed off a lot of the questions. So, for example, he said he would sort the pension scheme. He would work out what to do. But he didn't actually give any ideas how that would be done or what he would do to plug that pension gap or how he would help pensioners. And that can't be very consoling for the pensioners who are listening, people who feel that they're losing a lot of their life savings, having seen BHS go into administration and their pension scheme now in the Pension Protection Fund. So I do think, you know, he is very light on detail.
That was Deborah Hargreaves from the High Pay Centre. So, Simon, where do things stand at the moment? Because Sir Philip Green said he would sort this out, basically. But are we any closer to understanding where this money for pensions is actually going to come from?
No, we're not. And I think there's also a question surrounding quite how big the deficit is, because there's a number of different ways of accounting for it. And so the figure that's been placed on it is this £570 million. But then there are some suggestions that that is a very much a worst-case scenario estimate and that it could be solved with less money. I mean, ultimately, what people are looking for is for Sir Philip Green to put his hand in his pocket. You know, he is a very wealthy businessman. Obviously, a lot of the assets are held in his wife's name, but they're looking for the Greens to pay up. And there is what's being investigated is this question of whether Sir Philip was too keen to quickly offload BHS because he wanted shot of the pension deficit, or whether he genuinely thought that the company had a better chance of success in the hands of its new owners.
And also, there's some. It's quite surprising that he wasn't told earlier that there was a problem with the pension fund.
Well, he did some finger pointing on Wednesday whilst sitting there and having a lot of fingers pointed at him. And Philip Green's fingers were pointed at the trustees and the regulators. And he said that this problem wasn't flagged early enough and that the trustees had made some terrible mistakes. He said when the problem was flagged to him, you know, he then became aware of it and he then started trying to do something about it. I mean, the question obviously does surround this sort of, A, there's an ethical issue and B, there's a regulation issue because, as we've said before, the reason why you've got watchdogs in place looking at things like final salary pension schemes is to stop people offloading a big deficit that they don't want and for selling off a company for a pound in order to just get shot of the deficit. So the question is, did Philip Green sell BHS for a pound because it was losing money, so he wanted it off his hands and he thought it had a better chance of success, or did he sell it for a pound because he knew that he didn't want to be on the hook for that pension scheme?
And obviously that's something that we definitely don't know the answer to. And what we really want to find out, I guess, is actually how much he's prepared to put into out of his own pocket to sort this out, because I say he made this very broad brush promise, didn't he, on Wednesday. Don't yet know actually what that's going to involve.
Well, there's been reports that he's offered varying sums, that he started at about, I don't know, something like 60 or 70 million, it was suggested, and then he's sort of upped this offer. But what needs to be arrived at is a solution that everyone's happy with. And I think probably what you'd find is that maybe a number the regulators might be happy with runs into a couple of hundred million, maybe 200-300 million, maybe even more. Whether Philip Green's going to be happy to pay that or not is another question. He says it's solvable. He says that he thinks it can be sorted out, that it doesn't need to go to the situation where it's taken over by the Pension Protection Fund and people lose money. But there, actually, Alex Brummer, our city editor on the Daily Mail, wrote quite an interesting column about it yesterday when he said that there is an issue surrounding if Philip Green does have to take some of this money out of his and his wife's accounts, so to speak, there's going to be a tax implication because it's offshore. It has to be brought back into the country, so there's going to be tax to pay. And if that situation does arrive, that will actually make it even more expensive for Philip Green to settle this bill. And I suspect that Philip Green didn't get to where he is today by paying more for things and settling larger bills than he needed to.
Well, we found out that he got a very good deal on coat hangers, didn't we? That's one of the gems that came out of the committee. Well, let's just hear him. He did at one point express contrition for what's happened to BHS.
Hopefully, over this next period of time we're here, you won't hear all the bad stuff everybody wants to keep writing about. Hopefully, I'll give you a fair and balanced view. If I've done something wrong, I'm happy to say, hands up, I've done something wrong. And you can be your own judge. As to, you know, I don't tell lies. I'll tell you exactly as it is. Anything I tell you, I'm going to show you. You know, contrary to everything that's getting written, I spent 15 years, nearly a third of my working career, with BHS. And probably the thing that got me into trouble was actually having too strong an emotional tie with both the people and the business. And I think if you went to ask all the people I worked with and work with me, as opposed to for me at BHS, I think they would all testify that I was honest, hard-working, and nothing is more sad than how this has ended. And I hope during the morning you'll hear there's certainly no intent at all on my part for anything to be like this, and it didn't need to be like this. And I just want to apologise to all the BHS people who've been involved in this and are involved, and I hope that by the end of the morning they'll hear everything and we can find some sensible solutions to some of the issues.
So, Lee, Sir Philip Green did sound fairly remorseful there. Does that help? Is that enough? What does he have to do next?
Well, you know, as we were touching on just then, he's got to sort this pensions issue out. I mean, let's face it, there's 20,000 workers that are going to be struggling to make ends meet now and have promises broken to them on their pension schemes. So, you know, first and foremost, that is the most important thing you can do. Work with a deal with the government to make this all right. But this is going to do massive damage to the retail industry. A big player like BHS going under anyway, but the mess that it's now finding itself in is just, you know, absolutely staggering. And it is good that this has happened. These talks have been happening. 6 uncomfortable hours on Wednesday of him being really grilled. And it was a really interesting sort of get the popcorn out and watch this. Because as a journalist, but even as an outsider, you know, people were talking about it. It really did gather attention that actually he was being held to account a little bit. It's just huge question marks about this whole deal, this whole selling it for £1 to this guy, Dominic Chappelle, who clearly there were some question marks around him, and had Philip Green done the due diligence? Well, he says he has, but I'd like to know more.
It was interesting trying to square, I think, that the man, you know, the king of retail, the man who has a real eye for a trend, certainly in some of his stores. I mean, Topshop, you know, he's done amazing things with that.
Indeed.
And in a lot of people are saying keeps a very close eye on things. With some of the answers he was giving yesterday around Dominic Chappelle and also around his awareness of the problems with the pension scheme, or in fact not. His reputation seems to be very hands-on, but judging by what he was saying on Wednesday, actually quite hands-off in some cases.
I suppose the one thing you could say in his defence is he is a major businessman. He's got different businesses. It probably is quite difficult to know all of the ins and outs intrinsically of every single aspect of all the businesses. Pensions is one of those sort of things, I would imagine, as an owner of a retail outlet, not really being your number one priority, going, oh, I wonder what the pension deficit's going to be like in 10, 20 years. And you're more looking at your sales, your ingoings, your outgoings in terms of what stock you're getting and what you're putting out. And that's just like basic businessman attributes. But, I mean, he's a very successful man, and I find it very difficult to believe that he didn't know that this problem was around the corner and that something needed to be done to sort of prevent this future catastrophe. But I think the big worry is, what other big names out there, big businesses, are running these sort of pension deficits? Are we going to have more BHS messes in the future?
Well, there are quite a few companies, aren't there? They've got these final salary schemes that are discovering that actually they are very, very expensive. And just one thing, Simon, to clear up before we leave this and move on to Brexit, because we're talking about people losing out if the pension fund goes into the pension, if the pension scheme goes into the pension protection fund, which it's likely to do unless, you know, Philip Green comes out with a sort of money to plug the gap. It does mean people will get a pension, won't they? But it's those who have been there for a long time will lose out because of the way the inflation is. You know, they won't get much of an inflation increase.
Yeah, there's two ways that people will lose out. So people who haven't retired yet are set to lose probably about 10% of what they would be entitled to. So it would be about 10% lower. But people who have already retired, their pensions should be protected. Basically, they should get what their pension is. However, they won't get before a certain date the inflation increases to their pension. And on a year-to-year basis, that isn't a huge sum of money. But as it compounds up over the years, it's very important and can make a big difference. And it's the bit that means that your pension keeps pace with the cost of living.
And especially if you've been a sort of BHS lifer, if you've got a lot of pension built up before 97, I think it was, when it starts to come in and you get the inflation. I mean, that's a lot of money you could be losing.
It is, yeah. And the other people who'd be hit actually as well are people who are probably very senior people at BHS who'd worked there for a long time, but who haven't retired yet. There is a cap on what they can get. And if you thought, you know, if you were a senior person there who was looking at retiring on £60,000-£70,000 a year final salary pension, which is an awful lot of money, but it's not unheard of, you know, if you're for very high earners, you've done a long time with a company, they stand to lose a substantial sum of money.
Okay, well, I'm sure that you'll be back on the programme discussing BHS in the not-too-distant future. But I think time to move on to Brexit now. I'm Sarah Pennells. You're listening to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. And editor Simon Lambert and Lee Boyce are here with me. And let's talk about Brexit. I think we should. Just 6 days to go to the referendum. But it seems that so much damage has already been done. Here's Nigel Farage and David Cameron basically slugging it out last week in one of the big debates.
I would just say this to you. Trade is not made by governments. Trade is not made by bureaucrats. It's made by people like you. You buy products. You choose to buy a product or you don't. And do you know what? Once we've divorced ourselves amicably from political union, we will then go on buying cars and wine and trading happily.
Thank you very much.
Well, we can certainly survive outside the EU. I think the question for us is, how do we thrive? How do we do best? How do we create opportunities and jobs and chances for our children and our grandchildren? That, to me, is what this debate is about. And I think what's so unique about it is the extraordinary consensus. 9 out of 10 economists, the governor of the Bank of England, the International Monetary Fund, all saying that they believe we would suffer a hit to our economy, a hit to jobs. And what that means for people is lower living standards, potentially lower wages, higher prices in our shops, and yes, potentially a recession. And I think it would be irresponsible for me, as your Prime Minister, not to warn of these things. After all, the IMF, the OECD, some of these bodies are actually paid to warn Prime Ministers when their economies face risks. So yes, we could find a way, but in my view, it's not the right way.
Well, I think it's fair to say it's reaching fever pitch. And on top of all that, the Bank of England's just announced yesterday, as expected, they're holding their base rate steady at 0.5%. And the Governor, Mark Carney, delivered his latest and presumably last public pronouncement before the referendum.
A vote to leave the European Union could have material economic effects on the exchange rate, on demand, and on the economy's supply potential. Effects that could affect the appropriate setting of monetary policy. The recent behavior of the foreign exchange market suggests that were the UK to vote to leave the EU, sterling's exchange rate would fall further, perhaps sharply. This would likely be consistent with changes to some of the real fundamentals that drive sterling, including the terms of trade, productivity, and risk premia. In isolation, a further fall in sterling would boost inflation over the policy horizon.
So it could be until 2020 before we see interest rates rising. That's the opinions there of Mark Carney. What do you think, Simon, about where is the weight of evidence really lying now with Brexit? And it's very hard to ask this question because if anybody has an opinion one way or the other, then, you know, it seems in some ways there's so much speculation, so few facts. It's very hard to be definite. But what's your sense and feeling?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, for those who don't have strong feelings, the Brexit campaigns have been a bit of a disaster, to be honest. I think that if you already knew what you thought, then it's been an opportunity to get more of what you thought. But if you're in the middle, and there are a lot of people in the middle, I've had a lot of questions from friends, family, colleagues, readers, saying we just don't trust any of this stuff that we're being told by either side. So where are the facts? How do we make our mind up? I mean, it was described brilliantly, I think, by one of the columnists in the Investor's Chronicle last week as like two sides shouting past each other, which I think pretty much accurately summed it up. And there hasn't been, you know, the leaflets and the claims on the leaflets that we've got through our doors. Me and Lee have spoken about this before. Seriously dubious quality, some of the stuff going on there.
From both sides.
And you've got the Chancellor and the Prime Minister promising war, pestilence and falling house prices. And then some of those things, for example, the pound might fall, inflation might rise, house prices might fall. Interest rates might have to go up. Well, if you said that to a lot of people, they might say, well, actually, I think some of those things are quite good. We quite like cheaper house prices. We think interest rates should go up. As far as I was aware, most of what the Bank of England's doing with monetary policy at the moment is actually designed to get inflation to rise anyway. And one of the things that they don't talk about in the inflation reports is the fact that also some of it goes towards keeping the value of the pound down because they don't want the pound to go up. So it's very difficult to put your finger on this. And I wrote my column about this week. And what I've done in there is just linked to a selection of articles, I think, where people have written informative, balanced things from either side. You know, should we stay in? Should we leave? And I would say to people, there's still just under a week to go. There's time to sit down, and if you haven't made your mind up, or even if you have made your mind up, there's time to sit down, spend a bit of time carefully reading some of this stuff, and come up with a measured decision about which way you think you should vote. Because ultimately, it is quite important, and it does matter, and it deserves the time that you can give it. What it doesn't deserve is the unedifying spectacle that we've seen from both the Remain and Leave camps.
And it has been, you know, entertaining on one level, but very depressing on another, Lee, hasn't it? That actually, you know, Simon mentioned this, that what people want, understandably and rightly so, they want some information. And now some of the information is going to be very hard to come by, if not impossible. Mm. But all we've had ever since the referendum date was launched, it was announced, is just basically lots of shouty politics, haven't we? And more heat, but very little light at all.
I think it's been a real shame, actually, because on both sides of the camp, the arguments have just been a little bit wrong for me. You know, they've gone too hard on certain things that, to me, just don't make sense. And like Simon, I have so many friends and family asking me how I'm voting Brexit, how they should vote in Brexit. They're in the middle. they want to know some facts about both things, and it's actually really quite difficult to find these facts. And that's why Simon's written his column this week and pointing to some information on both Leave and the Remain sides. And it's very good. It is worth reading and getting yourself armed up with that knowledge, because we are very close now to the vote. But two things I will say about Brexit, and I mentioned this before when I was on. I mean, a massively key word for me is the word could. So there's a lot of, like, you know, this could happen. Pound could go down. House prices could fall. They could rise. We just don't know. We just don't know what could happen if we left the EU. It's really difficult to put your finger on it. Number two, I think we really, really reached peak Brexit mania this week with the whole going down the Thames on boats and shouting at each other. And when Bob Geldof got involved, I mean, it really is surreal. People must be looking in from other countries going, is this British politics? What is this? What has this come to?
How did we ever let them into this club in the first place? Probably thinking. But also, Brexit campaigner Priti Patel was saying that Mark Carney, Bank of England governor, just employing scare tactics and it's a partisan move. Is he just doing his job and warning when he thinks things may, you know, there may be problems? Or do you think there is some politicking involved, Simon?
So I actually have an element of sympathy here with Mark Carney. A part of Mark Carney's job is basically financial stability, and that's part of the Bank of England's remit. Now, it would seem abundantly clear to me that if part of your job involves financial stability for the UK, the most likely course of action in order to have financial stability would be to maintain the status quo, rather than taking a big leap off into the unknown. I don't think that anyone could deny that that would create more volatility and create a more unstable situation. And I think that he has, in a relatively measured way, you know, pointed out the risks. Maybe he hasn't made enough of the fact that there could be some benefits down the line, but nobody really knows what those are. And the best report that I've seen on this in terms of the long-term economic outlook was the one commissioned by Neil Woodford's firm from Capital Economics. And that basically came to the conclusion that they couldn't see any long-term economic argument for either Remain or Leave. And that ultimately, over the short term, there'd be volatility. Over the long term, it would probably iron itself out. I mean, the one thing that we do know is trade. Trade is the issue. Britain is a great trading nation, has always been a great trading nation. And if we vote to leave, we will be voting ourselves out of probably the world's best free trade bloc. And so I have always wondered, do people on the other side of the world look at us and think, are they absolutely insane? You know, why would you vote yourself out of that? Or do they look at it and think, well, the problems of the EU are so big, and the big issue with the EU at the moment is the Eurozone, and the only way that the EU and the Eurozone is going to try and deal with that problem is by going for closer and closer and closer unity, and that's going to fall apart. And I think someone described it as better to be sitting in a lifeboat in the Channel watching that rather than being involved in it. So I don't know, didn't know which way this was looked at, but I actually got the chance to ask someone a question about this yesterday at dinner. As you know, fund manager, works in Asia, worked out in Asia for 23 years, and I said, what's the view over there? Has this even registered? And he said, to be perfectly honest, over in Asia, it hasn't really registered at all. And the people aren't talking about it. They don't pay that much attention to it.
Which probably tells you all you need to know. But, well, here's Remain campaigner Hilary Benn arguing that, partisanship or not, the economic arguments for Remain are stronger.
The evidence from all of the economists, the surveys, the Bank of England, the IMF, the IFS, all of them say, and you know how rare it is to get economists to agree on anything.
Well, there are some dissenting voices.
Well, they're very few and far between, indeed. And we just heard Michael Howard talk about Australia negotiating a trade arrangement with Europe. What he neglected to point out is that the Prime Minister of Australia, the Prime Minister of Canada and of New Zealand, along with a lot of other world leaders, are calling on us not to leave. And what is absolutely clear is it is a great risk to vote to leave the European Union. All the analysis that's been done says that the economy will take a hit, yep, and that is going to affect, above all, people on the lowest incomes. And damaging our economy, damaging trade, investment and growth, our security, our influence in the world, isn't going to help deal with any of the problems that we face.
So last thought then, Simon, before we leave this topic, as you say, 6 days. Are we actually going to get any more facts between now and then? Are we going to get any facts, do you think, or is it too late for that?
I don't think, as I said before, I don't think it's too late to go out and find some facts yourself and, you know, sit down and read some stuff that's measured. The other thing I'd say is read things that you don't agree with read the point of view of the side that you err against, and weigh those things up as well. And I think there's a lot to be said for better the devil you know. But then imagine if all of the world's, you know, inventors and innovators and entrepreneurs had thought that as well. We wouldn't have had a great deal of progress. But I think for a lot of people, the economic arguments are important. But I think a lot of people are going to vote on a question of immigration and sovereignty. So, you know, maybe some of the economic facts and figures that we're talking so much about won't be the thing that decide it at the end of the day.
Well, I said we're going to stop talking about Brexit, but I lied because we're actually going to talk a bit more about the pound.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.
And I'm joined by This Is Money's editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs editor Lee Boyce. We've been talking about Brexit. Well, now we're going to focus on the pound. The ONS have released the final set of inflation figures before the referendum, with the inflation rate remaining at 0.3%. Now, the rate isn't expected to do anything in the near future, but Howard Archer at IHS Global Insight thinks a Brexit would change all of that. He's warning that if we leave, we can expect a sharp weakening in sterling, with the attendant upward impact on consumer price inflation. So let's just unpick this kind of rate first. Some things go up in prices, others down. Lee, with inflation, how is this balance maintained? Simon was talking earlier on about Mark Carney. One of the things he's responsible for is financial stability. So kind of what levers does he have at his disposal to try and make sure that inflation doesn't yo-yo all over the shop?
Well,
technical term, by the way.
Yeah, well, he's struggling at the moment, isn't he? Because the target inflation is 2%. And it's really struggling to get out of the 0.5% area. And a lot of that has been weighed heavily by, you know, things that are in the basket of goods of inflation. Things like food prices have been falling. Up until recently, petrol prices, you know, the cost to fill up your car had been falling. But that actually started to nudge ahead a little bit more now. So that's gone up a little bit higher. But it's a real balancing act. And, you know, with Mark Carney and set a base rate, it's been at 0.5%. You know, talking about base rate, I mean, that's been there since 2009. I mean, I've started my journalistic career then, and it hasn't moved since then. And it's all of these sort of fine-tuning things that can really sort of unbalance, you know, the growth of inflation, etc. So it's a difficult act, and it's really hard to hit this target when all the different things that are going on. I'm sure Simon can explain it much better for you.
I thought that was probably made a fairly good fist of it myself, actually.
I thought so, yeah.
What about this? Let's just look at the rate, because you were saying earlier on that actually Mark Carney might want to try and, you know, the rate, the target rate's higher, much higher. 0.3%. Are we supposed to be worrying about stagflation, deflation, or are we supposed to be enjoying the fact that prices aren't running away with us and we don't have to worry about, you know, things being more expensive next week, next month?
I think at the moment the official line is that we're meant to be enjoying it. That was what we were told to do.
Enjoy
it while it lasts, I think, was Mr. Carney's words, as we sort of fell towards 0% inflation, especially after, you know, this period over the last couple of years of low inflation comes after a period of stubbornly above target inflation for quite a long time. And I think that if you look at the inflation chart for the UK, what you will see is that the UK is very much at the mercy of lots of other things and lots of other places when it comes to inflation. And that realistically, we had very stubborn high inflation, which was to do with things like the rising cost of energy, the rising cost of petrol, the weakening of the pound, making our things that we import and we buy, because we import and buy a lot of things in this country, more expensive. And then you've seen this sort of slow growth, fall in the oil price, fall in energy prices, and that sent inflation down. Now, obviously, the Bank of England now finds itself in the position where it needs to get inflation up. So what can it do? Well, it could cut interest rates, but there's, you know, cutting below 0.5%, there's not really a very long way to go. We've seen there's this thing, the zero lower bound, the point below which you can't cut interest rates any further and make any difference, because people then start hoarding cash. And we've seen the reaction to the suggestion of negative interest rates and negative interest rates in some places this year. And it wasn't pretty. Basically, you know, banks and the financial system said, whoa, we don't like this negative interest rates thing in January and February. And toys were thrown out of the pram. So I'm not sure that negative interest rates are the way to go, and I don't really think the Bank of England's got much appetite for cutting interest rates. So what could it do then? I mean, there's unconventional stuff. There's more QE. I don't think it really wants to do more QE. There's pumping more money into the system in the way that it did with funding for lending. Funding for lending worked in a way because it pumped a load of money into the housing market, and you know, we love the housing market in this country,
we do.
But I don't think we want to pump up house prices any further. So what do you do then? Do you do something like helicopter money, where you just drop money onto people? This idea of just giving people free money to spend? I don't think we're at that point yet. But, you know, get another really bad recession and who knows?
Well, we had the announcement from George Osborne saying that, you know, he could impose an emergency budget if we do leave. We were talking earlier on about all the predictions about what could happen in terms of inflation rising, house prices falling, etc., etc. Here's John Springford, who's Senior Fellow at the Centre for European Reform, speaking to Share Radio earlier.
I think it's not really necessary, and I think that we shouldn't necessarily believe George Osborne when he says that he's going to do this.
So why say it?
Well, I mean, the obvious reason why he's saying it is because he wants to highlight the fact that when we leave the EU, most you know, decent, reputable organisations think that it's going to blow a bit of a hole in the public finances. And so for George Osborne, highlighting this issue is extremely important. And he's highlighting the idea of having an emergency budget to bring the conversation around to the economics.
So what do you think? I mean, is this a realistic option, or is it just one of those things that actually can focus the mind in the way that the politicians might want our minds to be focused before the referendum?
I think probably the latter. I think it's just a bit of a warning of, whoa, watch out here. I'm not quite sure why he might need to impose some extra income tax on us if we left the EU. That wasn't really fully explained beyond this general suggestion that things would be really, really bad. I also thought that we passed a law saying that we couldn't raise income tax, didn't we? Didn't the Conservatives say that they were going to do that? Didn't they actually do that? They passed a law saying they wouldn't raise income tax. So, I mean, he's saying he'd break the law. It's very serious stuff.
Chancellor breaking the law over next.
I know, well, but I think that what's interesting about it is that this suggestion of we might have to raise income tax if we vote to leave the EU, but maybe we should be having a conversation about whether we need to raise income tax to pay for the massive deficit that the NHS has got. I mean, I think we could be having a lot more sensible conversations around what we'd be doing with an extra couple of pennies of income tax.
That's a whole different programme. And we're going to leave Brexit in a moment, but we have just got one thing to look at. You're listening to Consuming Issues. I'm Sarah Pennells, and we've got editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce here with the award from the award-winning This Is Money. And this is in part partnership with NS&I. Now, we've been looking at the domestic effects that a Brexit could have and may indeed already be having. But what about all the money going abroad? As investors get more and more concerned about the effects of a referendum, money's streaming out of the UK looking for a safe haven, and a lot of it is going into the Japanese yen. Japanese currency has been pushed up to a three-year high against the euro, bolstering confidence a little maybe, but also the Brexit vote is making the Japanese a bit nervous as well. Here's Dr. Sejiro Takeshita from the University of Shizuoka speaking with Share Radio earlier with a Brexit view from Japan.
There's always the worry that the Japanese multinational enterprises will basically regress their funds back into Japan, and basically flight to safety means that they would be running for the yen. And obviously, because there's a very strong correlation in the current Japanese market with the foreign exchange rates, you're seeing the market plummet. So we're getting these very, very much of a negative cycle that basically is from the Brexit. And the Japanese number one concern, obviously, is the perpetuity of the Britain being the window for the Japanese European businesses, which is exactly the same for the Americans as well. So there is this continued worry, and the Japanese still do not have a full comprehension about what's going on in Europe as a whole, especially in regards to the immigration process. So, of course, they get the news, but they really don't understand the depths of this darkness. And for that reason, many people are looking at this incident with anxiety and wondering how far this could actually go.
And Simon, I mean, the Japanese yen wouldn't, I think, to most people seem to be the obvious safe haven. So, you know, what's the kind of danger of money flowing out of something like, you know, UK pound, dollar into a currency like this? Is there, what's the downside?
Well, I think that there's probably a wider issue here, certainly than Brexit. But to look at the Brexit thing, people talk about the market as a weighing mechanism. It weighs up the scenario and the move of money and currency and people's investments. And the weighing mechanism has basically decided that we are a lot more likely to vote out than it previously thought that we were. Not that we're going to vote out, but that we are more likely than previously thought. So there has been a big outflow of money, you know, from British companies, British assets, basically sterling denominated assets, as people have gone, well, I'm just going to put my money somewhere I think it's a bit less open to extreme volatility in case that this out thing comes. Then with the Japan thing, what's going on here is this big wave of money that moves around the world, you know, due to the perception of what's going to happen with interest rates and economies. And Japan made some noises recently that it might not push further into negative rates. Negative rates might not be working that well. There might not be lots more quantitative easing to come from Japan. And that means that basically money in Japan, monetary policy, although exceptionally loose, now looks slightly tighter than it was. So people are going to move their money into somewhere where they think that monetary policy is getting a little bit tighter. It's the trajectory. And that's why, you know, in the US, actually, the dollar appreciated a lot last year because people thought that the US were going to raise interest rates four times this year. As it happened, they've raised rates once at the end of last year and they haven't gone up again since. And there's a suggestion maybe one more this year, maybe not even this year. And that's seen money start to move out of the dollar because that expectation of tightening there has eased off.
And it feels on one level, although we haven't got many facts, that there's not much more we can say on Brexit. But what would your sort of final thoughts be on this? Because this time next week, it'll all be over, apart from the counting.
I think my final thoughts would be do your own research. Think carefully about it. Find the time to read some stuff that's worth reading. Make your decision. And then at the end of it, whatever the result is, you know, we can all try and do what's best for Britain.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
I'm Sarah Pennells, here with the team from This Is Money, the financial website of the year. Coming up, legal squabbles over UK money lost by Spanish banks. But first, let's turn our attention to property, where we're going to be taking a look at mortgages. Now, choosing the right one can be tricky, almost impossible. So many deals on offer, so many perks and angles to take advantage of, whether it's cheap rates, no fees, free valuation, cashback. But there are often hidden costs to valuation and legal fees, and exit or redemption fees can end up adding hundreds of pounds to your overall payments. So, I mean, mortgages, for many people, they are a complete minefield. So where do we begin on that? Why are they so complicated, Lee?
Well, you know, there's loads of things to weigh up and consider, especially, you know, if you're a first-time buyer, it really can be quite a confusing system. But what the point of our investigation here by our new mortgage reporter, Sarah Davidson, she's compared some of the deals that are currently on offer and actually how confusing all the sums of money can be. We do actually have on This Is Money a true cost of mortgage calculator, which crunches all the fees, all the additional extras, so how much you're actually going to pay over the two-year term or five-year term or however long it is that you've taken, if you've taken a fixed mortgage out. But she's compared two mortgages here, and I think this is very interesting. There's one from Nationwide Building Society and one from TSB. Now, Nationwide charges £999 product fee. It's just a fee for starting the mortgage process, whereas TSB charges £995. So pretty similar. But here's when it starts getting a little bit more complicated and a little bit more difficult. Nationwide offers a free valuation, whereas TSB will charge you £400. And that's for a valuation that you never see the light of day. You know, it's not
for the mortgage lender, not for you.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
And then Nationwide offers £500 cash back. So you'll get that after completion, whereas TSB doesn't. Nationwide charges £65 to remortgage. TSB charges £265. So when you're further down the line thinking about perhaps getting a new deal, you're going to face another fee, and they vary. And this is just two lenders. It can vary wildly between other lenders. Nationwide charges £200 for a home buyer report, which is the one you get to see, whereas TSB, £750. I mean, that's a huge difference.
That's a lot, actually, for one of those surveys. It's not even the full building survey, which is the top of the range Rolls-Royce one, isn't it?
Exactly. So the rates may be the same, the headline rate that you're paying, the interest, but all of these little things can add up and really add to your mortgage. And it might not be a cost that you consider, because I think people are so keen to be looking at the headline price that they're paying for the property that they start to lose track of all the smaller figures that start to add up, and you kind of just gloss over it. You're thinking, I want this house now. I can't read into all of this. But I think that the thing to take out from this report is to really just compare, you know, every aspect of the mortgage, any sneaky exit fees that might crop up if you want to change to a different lender at the end of your term. There's all sorts of things to consider, and I would urge you to use True Cost Mortgage Calculator to really get to the gritty of what it's going to cost you.
You're saying that people concentrate on the price of the property and probably the headline rate. I mean, to be honest, you probably lose interest in all the other costs and fees, because it gets the terminology is baffling, and as you say, they all have different fees. I'm not a cynical journalist, and I know that you aren't either, but do you think the lenders make it more difficult, or do you think it's just a byproduct of the market we have?
I think they do make it more difficult. I think they could make it a simpler process. I think some good has come recently, especially with MMR. You know, I think some changes in that have been
mortgage market review.
Exactly. Yeah. So some of that stuff's been really good. And we were again talking about this not so long ago, but HSBC now offering a one-day service mortgage instead of it being a really long, drawn-out process. They say that they could give you a decision on the day, which I think is good. I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to be the biggest thing you ever purchase, and you can't rush into these things, and you've really got to look at the paperwork and know what you're dealing with. But more of that sort of explaining it in one day when you've got your head really into it, it's probably a good way to go. And some of these fees, I mean, I've always wondered, like £999 for a product fee, and that's not the worst of it. Some of them, £1,500 sometimes. It's a lot of money for what essentially is probably just some paper pushing, in my opinion.
Sort of permission to buy their product, isn't it, really?
Exactly, it's kind
of,
yeah.
And what about going it alone versus getting advice from an independent mortgage broker? What's your view on that?
I recently took out a mortgage and I used a broker, and actually I thought it was very good. And even though I know what deals are out there, I know what percentage wise, you know, it was really good at explaining to me. I was tempted to go with a 5-year fix, for example, but my broker persuaded me to go for a 2-year fix, and now I'm looking at interest rates potentially not going to go up to 2020. It seems like it's been the right decision. But not only that, he picked me out a deal that did get me some good cash back, you know, did consider the product fee and all the other additional bits to it. But that doesn't mean don't go it alone, because, you know, sometimes you really can be armed with the information. And if you are, you know, HSBC customer, for example, I'd actually probably make my first port of call to go into the branch and go and have a chat with them, and then perhaps go and have a look at what else is out there. But I suppose whatever suits you best.
I think maybe especially if you're a first-time buyer, or if you're self-employed, or if you've just recently changed, you're on a contract, mm-hmm. and you've just changed contracts, all those things. I mean, I've used a broker more times than not, and certainly when I was a first-time buyer, I mean, I found it so helpful to have some of the terminology explained, because I didn't have the same forensic interest I have now in finance, and the terminology is baffling. The process, it's all new, isn't it?
It is. And also another thing I've said to the broker is that he really helped, you know, fill in the paperwork and do all of the sort of stuff, you know, underlying stuff that I really didn't probably have the time to do. I should have make the time to do it, but you know what I mean, working life gets in the way. And he also pointed out anything that right at the beginning of the process which could make us be declined a mortgage. For example, my girlfriend wasn't on the electoral roll. You know, I kind of knew it, but I just didn't really let it collate. And we got her on the electoral roll, made her credit rating better, and essentially the whole system was pretty smooth.
It's one of those things, because you don't think there should be a connection between being able to vote and applying for a mortgage or credit card. But it's because the mortgage lenders, basically, they check that you are who you say you are.
Exactly.
That's kind of why it matters. So what are your tips then for somebody who does want to go it alone, or even just wants to do their own research before they see a mortgage broker? Mm. What are your tips for kind of try and battle your way through this mortgage maze?
Definitely use a calculator, a mortgage calculator. We talked about this recently, how they do vary between lender to lender, so you're probably better off going on an independent website and having a check and seeing roughly how much your mortgage repayment is going to be for certain percentages. And then there's such a raft of information out there now, best buy tables of mortgages. I think most important thing to do is decide whether you want a fixed rate or if you want a variable rate. and then just have a compare and have a bit of a mess around and see. Just don't get sucked in by the headline rate. That's what I would say. Make sure you do look at all of these sneaky extras and just do your own research. And it's not a bad thing to do.
I would go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgages.
Would you really?
Well, yeah, I would, funnily enough. I don't know why I'm suggesting that. But if you go there, you will find our What Next for Mortgage Rates Roundup, which basically explains what's going on with interest rates, why mortgage rates are where they are, what the outlook is for them, details some of the best deals on the market, and also explains what you need to think about if you're trying to weigh up the fix versus tracker question, how long you should fix for, 2, 3, 5 years. So I'd go read that, read some other things as well, do your research, and I would speak to a broker. And the advantage of a broker nowadays is that mortgage interviews take a long time and they're quite onerous. Now, in the old days, that wasn't the case. But now, if you want to go from bank to bank, then you could find yourself spending 2 hours on the phone to one bank. So if you've got to go do that with a number of banks, that's going to be a real pain. Whereas if you do it with a broker, you only have to do it once with the broker, and then the broker does all the legwork for you. But I would find out the information, because I would say to people, do question what the broker says to you. So if the broker says to you, you should take a 2-year fix, and you think that you'd be better off with a 5-year fix, ask them why they're recommending a 2-year fix. Are they recommending a 2-year fix because they think it's better for you? Or are they recommending a 2-year fix because they'd like your business again in 2 years' time when they get another commission payment from a mortgage lender? And if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgages, you'll also find a button there where you can click and go to our mortgage finder, and you can put in your own personal details and it'll tell you what the best rates are for you.
Great stuff. Well, I'm here with editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from the award-winning This Is Money. And this is in partnership with NS&I.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.
We've been talking about mortgages. All well and good if you can afford to buy in the first place, but new numbers from the ONS are showing house prices are rising even further across Britain. Adding to the confusion is a £100,000 gap between the ONS figures and those from the Land Registry, which the latter of which has been retired. So what's going on? Here's Paul Whitlock of Chartered Savings Bank on Share Radio early this week.
If you look at them, they're saying that the average house price in London, but just in March, was £535,000, yeah. And the ONS £552,000. Okay. It's reasonably consistent. And then this new index comes along and says that the average price of a home in London is £470,000. Now, you might be a little bit sceptical and suggest that perhaps the discrepancies are just down to the methods of data collection. Yeah. I think I'm more inclined, until we get a little bit more information on that, I think first numbers out the doors, it just looks like a discrepancy in the way that they're calculating this.
So, Simon, what is the difference between these two different ways of measuring house prices, and does it really mean anything?
If you're a geek like me and have spent a long
always
time...
Always a good way to start a sentence,
and,
I think.
Yeah, and have spent a long time writing about house prices, then you will know the ins and outs of some of these house price surveys. Although actually knowing the real nitty-gritty detail is something probably best left to people who speak pure statistics. But if you aren't a geek like me and probably haven't spent many years writing about house prices, you might wonder why there's this massive gap between what the Nationwide or the Halifax or the Land Registry or the ONS says is the average house price. And it's because they're all calculated differently. But what's happened this week is we've had the first set of new official statistics where the old ONS index, which said the average house price was £290,000, has been merged with the old Land Registry monthly index, which said the average house price was £190,000. There's quite a big difference between those two things. And it's to do with the way that the two were calculated. And we always used to get a lot of comments from readers on the Halifax or the Nationwide reports saying, well, I'll wait for the Land Registry monthly reports. That's the one that tells you the real values. But it doesn't really, because the Land Registry monthly one excluded quite a lot of properties. It excluded all new build properties, and its repeat sales regression method, see, I told you I was a geek,
steady on,
basically, excluded properties that have been held long term. So, for example, say there was a property that had been held by a family had owned it for 10, 15, 20 years and it hadn't been sold in that time, then it wouldn't be included in it. So there was a lot of properties that were excluded. This new one takes actual transaction prices from the Land Registry. Then it uses information from the Council of Mortgage Lenders Regulated Mortgage Survey to try and overlay some sort of property attributes onto it as well. And it also uses some council tax data. and it covers the whole of Britain, whereas the old land registry one just did England and Wales. And the idea is that this will come up with a much better and more definitive answer as to what the average house price is, which is now £209,000, a mere £80,000 less than it was last month.
Who knew house price indices were so fascinating? Well, obviously we did. Well, you're listening to Consuming Issues, and we've got Simon Lambert, who's the editor of the award-winning This Is Money website, and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Now, I'm going to move seamlessly from UK prices to some UK money being stuck in overseas property. See what I did there?
For many, it was to be their dream home, endless sun and great value. But the Spanish property boom all went wrong in 2008. Thousands of British investors lost a fortune when they paid large deposits to secure apartments being built off plans. But when the developers went bust, as many did, all those cash deposits were lost. Stephanie Davis and her ailing husband handed over €77,000 to a Spanish developer to secure her dream home by the Med. She lost it all.
Absolutely gutted. It's an awful lot of money to lose. And we just couldn't believe it, I suppose.
But Stephanie's luck may be turning.
Well, it may indeed be turning. So just explain, what is this new development and how could it help people like Stephanie Lee?
Well, in the run-up to the financial crisis, lots of people were buying off-plan properties overseas. And Spain, one of the most popular places for expats to buy property, you know, either second home or to go out there. Now, what's happened is they thought the money was lost, and they thought basically they'd hit a brick wall. There's been a new ruling by the Supreme Court in Madrid, basically saying that Spanish banks are to be held to account for this, because the deposits obviously went through Spanish banks. So, I mean, it's a great development for people. You know, it's thought to be 100,000 people affected by this. And that's a large sum of people that have probably lost out their life savings, or at least a large chunk of their life savings to this. And it's not just Spain. We've reported on other countries in the past where actually now it looks like people are going to be able to fight back. So, for example, there was a ruling in Cyprus, another popular place to buy a holiday home or to retire. And a lot of people there bought properties off plan that either weren't built or the firms went into administration and people lost their money. But there was a court ruling there where now people look like they're going to be able to do some class action and actually get some of this money back. Some of the cases are absolutely soul destroying, and there's loads of lessons learned obviously in the financial crisis, and unfortunately this is one that a lot of British pensioners probably felt the most. For example, that case study of Stephanie, I mean, that is such a large sum of money to lose, and that was in 2006. They put a deposit down, a financial crisis came along and just absolutely destroyed it all. The firm went into administration, and unfortunately it was a case of a lot of firms. They went into administration before actually building a property.
So when do you think people might get a refund?
Well, it's already been, you know, probably a decade or so since these cases first started to come to light. There's no idea, there's no sort of indicator of how long this could be, but you'd like to think if the Supreme Court has ruled it in Madrid, that these cases will probably come in a bit of a class action. There will be certain law firms that will take the cases on and do them as a sort of bulk case. Usually there's a test case in these sort of scenarios where someone will go through it, they'll get their money back, and then there'll be a flood of these cases, and there'll be quite quick turnarounds. It won't be like long drawn out cases for each person that's involved in this. You would have thought it'd be quite quick. Hopefully, you know, if they take it seriously, we could still be looking at the next 18 months, 2 years. I would put an estimate on it.
Great stuff. Well, thanks very much, editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Thank you so much for joining me, and we'll see you again next week.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.